from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, the 2nd of September, 2020, and so glad to have you with us on the Dave Graham Show here this morning. We are going to be talking first off with David Zuckerman. He's the Democratic nominee for governor of Vermont, won the primary on August 11th, and he's going to talk to us, I think, a little bit about how the fall campaign is shaping up and a couple of the issues that have been percolating up in the news in the last few days regarding school reopenings and Black Lives Matter activities and et cetera, et cetera. All the sort of standard topics we're all talking about these days, it seems. We'll be covering some of those with Mr. Zuckerman. In the second half hour, we have an interesting conversation, I think, lined up with a chemistry professor at the University of Vermont. The man's name is Waterman, actually. Kind of interesting. That's a famous name at UVM. We'll have to ask him if he's any relation to the campus building, Waterman. Anyway, Rory Waterman will be talking with us about an effort to impart greater diversity in the sciences. This involves, I think, 21 different universities and colleges around the country. They've gotten a little bit of funding. They're trying to promote the idea of getting more women and people of color into the hard sciences. And then later on in the program, before it gets too late in the season, I wanted to talk about the boating boom. It seems like I don't know if anybody's out, well, a lot of people out there apparently have gone to boat launches around the state. They tend to be pretty crowded these days. A lot of people getting into boating. It's a good way, I guess, to maintain some social distancing when you're out there in the water, and good fun activity. And we're going to be speaking with a couple of boat dealers, actually, people who sell boats in the second hour of the program. Mike Baudet of Gilly Sales and Service in East Montpelier and Steve Bromley of Umiak Outdoor Outfitters based in Stowe. They have a couple other stores as well, including one in Waterbury and one in Richmond. We will be talking with them in the second hour of the program. But wanted to catch up with Dave Zuckerman between the farm chores and the farm deliveries and all the other stuff farmers do this morning. I believe he's on the phone with us. Good morning, Dave Zuckerman.
Good morning, Dave Graham. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us this morning and having a little time to spare to get together with us on WDEV. By the way, I just want to let our listeners know we have been trying to reach out to Governor Phil Scott. He's the incumbent Republican governor and running for a third two-year term in November. And, we like to get all sides on the Dave Graham Show, and we have hoping to maybe track him down next week to get him on and talking about the campaign and the issues he's running on for a third term and that sort of thing. But today it's Mr. Zuckerman's turn. So, Dave, I wanted to check with you. You were out and quite outspoken yesterday on the subject of Governor Phil Scott. You think not doing a very good job leading the state's efforts to get kids back to school. Where is he coming up short?
Well, it's been a series of things, and what I've heard from some teachers, a number of principals, and some superintendents around the state, is that there's just been a lack of clarity on some of the broader health guidelines. If you think about it, our educators have been through schooling and training on how to give critical thinking skills and information to kids and how to teach in a classroom that's under normal circumstances, but they've never been trained in science and epidemiology around infectious diseases and what you do in circumstances like a pandemic. I don't think any of us really, most of us have been trained in these ways. And while the state gave out some information and guidelines, it could have done a lot more to coordinate the effort across the state with respect to getting supplies, with respect to funding of the retrofits that have had to happen or could have happened in the schools. Some of the things I talked about included back in May or April could have said, you know what, it's clear from the projections with this thing that the fall is still going to be really precarious. Why not have September be Outdoor Education Month and have teachers planning for teaching outdoors, a lot of, could be natural science is teaching. It could be sitting outdoors when the weather is better. It could be lining up tents and supporting our sort of the outdoor events companies, which now I think a lot of those tents have been bought up or rented up. But on a statewide coordinated effort of particularly buying supplies, we did that with our medical professionals. The state was trying to procure PPE. Well, why not have the state procure the sanitizers and the supplies for teachers and work on finding all the plumbers and electricians and others to retrofit our schools to have more hands-free doors and sinks and bathroom amenities so that we reduce those touch points where a lot of this transmission was suspected. Obviously, that's less so now, but with a number of kids in a tight space, HVAC systems, those could have also been worked on with support from the state.
As the governor was saying yesterday, I think in one of his biweekly news conferences, this pandemic is still only 6 months old. It seems as though the landscape shifts from time to time, depending on whether the incidence of COVID-19 are rising nationwide or appear to be plateauing or even shrinking a little bit. It has come on, really, really fast. You think about other state government efforts, things like reforming Act 250 or getting cannabis legalized. A lot of times, state government just doesn't move that fast. Do you have any sympathy for the speed with which all of this has come on and the shifting circumstances?
Of course, and I've stated many, many times compliments for the governor for many aspects of handling of COVID. I also think a lot of compliments, frankly, deserve to go to Dr. Levine, who's done a phenomenal job. And I remember looking back in March and April as he was working who knows how many hours a day. You could see the exhaustion, and I just thought, that guy is trying to understand the science and then trying to advise the governor and trying to make sure the information is relayed in a way that, all of us lay people could understand well. And, he really is, I think, the biggest hero in the state. And then the people of Vermont. When you look at other states and the pushback from the general public around some of the wise things that we could be doing and should be doing, which is keeping some space and distance, wearing masks, and so forth, the people of Vermont really looked out for their neighbors by doing the inconveniences for self that would help the state as a whole. So I think the governor deserves credit, Dr. Levine deserves a ton of credit, the people of Vermont. No, I'm not just out here throwing bombs. I think it is important to, when you're campaigning for an office, look at where you would do things differently. It was just stated in Digger, I think, yesterday in response to this, his campaign, we're not going to campaign in the political attack style that's typical in races. I'm not attacking the governor. I'm pointing out ways I would do things differently, and I think voters deserve to hear how we would all do things, kick the tires, look at us in the eye as best we can in this environment, and get a sense of what we would do. And, I appreciate that the governor is talking about focusing primarily on COVID these days. At the same time, Vermont is a small state. There are much larger states where governors are no longer doing multiple press conferences a week, dominating the media airwaves, and utilizing sort of the office as a campaign platform. And frankly, that's what part of those things has become when you listen to the questions that are asked and the answers that are given. And at some point, you've got to go back to governing and, yes, doing the regular press conferences, but not using the event as a political platform.
I wanted to ask you also just about the current state of race relations and protests and concern about police violence, et cetera, nationwide, and how that is playing out in Vermont. It seems one flashpoint, of course, is Burlington right now, where we've had big demonstrations. I think 500 people yesterday calling for the dismissals of three Burlington police officers over incidents of alleged misconduct. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that these folks have a justified demand for these officers to be dismissed?
Well, you know, what happens, it seems to happen in government, is generally you try to push problems under the rug for a long time until they become such hot potatoes that you get into these flashpoint situations. And this is true whether it's an employee situation where, you know, they keep, well, there's the contract that, you know, you can't just fire someone and you do have to follow contract. But it also means when people do the incidents that these three officers have done, they need to be written up and disciplined properly, because if you do the proper paper chain in all of these union contracts, you would then have the means for dismissal. But when folks are either coddled or whatnot within the system, and the concerns of the citizenry are not taken into account, you get to a flashpoint situation. And, you know, we in Vermont have struggled with racial inequities in law enforcement now for decades. There have been policies made that are moving in the right direction, but the impact has not been felt by the black and brown community as far as feeling equally treated under the law. And so people have a right to be frustrated. And folks, we need to train law enforcement not to be, you know, potentially shooting folks in the back, as happened in Kenosha. You know, there isn't an imminent threat if someone's running away from a law enforcement officer, unless they're running towards someone else to harm them. And I don't think that was the situation in Wisconsin. But, you know, here in Vermont, we've had these instances, and it doesn't feel as though the disciplinary action matches the abuse of the authority given to people who are law enforcement police officers who are really supposed to be trying to keep the peace. So I think the citizenry is right to be frustrated, and we need to listen and figure out a way to address the concerns and bring this whole situation into a more tempered, peaceful, well, it is generally peaceful, I should say. Marching in streets, using one's voice, is peaceful. I did hear or read about a rock being thrown. You know, that crosses the line, you know, as does the issues of what the law enforcement have done on occasion, or individuals in law enforcement. So we just need to make sure we all don't cross lines where people can get hurt. And that's the first and foremost priority.
We had an incident, I guess, in Burlington where a man from Winooski was arrested after he approached protesters with an assault-style weapon.
That's right.
And,
need vigilantism. You know, we law enforcement is there, and I know it doesn't always feel like it, but they are there to protect everyone. I've talked to some people who felt that law enforcement's presence at some of these rallies was intimidating, and when I look out at a group of 500 or 1,000 people, that can be intimidating to a lot of folks, and law enforcement is not there to be intimidating. In fact, when I reach out to law enforcement, they point out that they are there because there's often counter-protests. You look at the situation in other places, and even here with this individual from Winooski who came in with a gun, law enforcement is there to also protect the right to peacefully assemble, which means when a counter-organization comes in, or an individual with a gun in that case, law enforcement is there to keep, you know, worse situations from happening, often in reaction to the assembly of protests and peaceful protests. I'm glad law enforcement was there, and I'm glad that nobody got hurt in that situation.
Yeah, the First Amendment talks about the right of people peaceably to assemble and petition their government for a redress of grievances. So clearly,
right.
It envisions gatherings of people who are complaining about something, basically. And I suppose that you could have a gathering of another group of people who are complaining about the complainers. And should there be, though, I look at that word peaceably, and I'm wondering, should there be any kind of a provision where would be a violation of law to bring a gun to such an event?
Well, you know, as far as I know, I haven't seen any folks who are in those initial gatherings, whether it was the one on the State House lawn that I was at, or the ones in Burlington. I've been to a few of those. I've not seen a single person who are demanding racial justice and accountability of law enforcement bringing or brandishing any gun. It's typically the counter-protesters who have been frothed up by this president to start, you know, basically doing vigilante justice. And that is not appropriate. It is not okay. And, you know, if the person, we in Vermont have fairly relaxed gun laws. The governor, in fact, vetoed a 24-hour waiting period for purchasing a gun just a year ago. You know, there needs to be the realization that people have guns for, you know, hunting and for self-protection. But if you bring your gun to an event to protest, and that is not about self-protection. That is about inciting. And we have language about inciting, riots and inciting events. And I think we have methods to use to, tamp that down. And I think law enforcement did that.
The any possible changes to the law where, you know, you could declare, I don't know, a certain section of a city where demonstrations are going on to be a firearms-free zone or something?
Well, it's certainly an interesting idea. I would have to talk to a lot of people from all sides before jumping to a conclusion as to whether that's a good idea or not. I don't know what law enforcement would think of that. I don't know what organizers of protests would think about that. I don't know what constitutional, legal experts would think of that. So I'd want to understand what the rights are currently and then say, yes, that's the right thing to do, or no, it isn't. Just because I think with any major change, you do need to do the critical analysis.
Let's shift gears a lot, and talk about some other issues going on in the state. One of which is that it looks like the legislature, the administration have kind of dodged a bullet on the budget crunch this year, the COVID related budget crunch in particular, mainly due to way bigger influx of tax revenues from last year than was expected, but we're hearing from all sides now that the 2020 fiscal the next fiscal year's budget writing activities are going to be really, really tough.
The economy is really taking a blow this year, and you're right. I mean, the governor has been very fortunate for 4 years. I mean, we had a strong economy, and he had the resources to do most of the things he would want in his budget, and it's a lot easier to be a laissez-faire governor in a good budget than it is when you've got harder times. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've been pointing out between myself and the governor is when things are good, you want to be building in resiliency for the future. And what did we do to really build up people's economic well-being? Well, he vetoed the minimum wage, which now we're saying essential workers deserve a hazard pay bump, but store clerks and stock shelfers, shelf stockers didn't get that because they weren't in the healthcare field. Well, they would have had $1,000 more in their pocket if the budget, you know, if the minimum wage hadn't been vetoed. And in this budget, yeah, the governor's been fortunate in that we had almost $100 million or a little over $100 million of additional revenue above expectations. And that's going to fill the hole this year. But even with that, he's really changing the nature of how budgets are normally done. When you get one-time funding, you don't typically use it to fund the sort of ongoing fixed costs of government. And this is an unusual time, so it's understandable that he's doing that. But he's got to be honest with folks that, you know, if we use all that money now, there is less money for next year, whereas if we were to spread some of that cost into next year and we were to say, for instance, the wealthiest folks, Jeff Bezos has $40 billion more dollars now than he did before the COVID crisis started. You know, Wall Street's doing pretty darn well, surprisingly. So if you go to the wealthiest Vermonters and said, this year we need your help to get us through the budget, and we'll carry some of this money forward to help us through next year, and we would ask the same, then you could have a smaller tax increase on the wealthiest to get us through some of this. You could use rainy day funds. We could spread the pain out over a few years. Instead, by front-loading it, we're going to make the appearance that we're fine now. Most Vermonters aren't going to see this kind of detail and think this through this way. and we're going to hit a huge wall next year that's going to be really painful. And that's what happens with short-term budgeting. That's what happens with political thinking about budgeting, where instead of it being a softer process over a couple of years, they're pushing the problem down the road. That's when things explode. I use that metaphor with the earlier conversation around racial injustice. When you push the problems out into the future, they get bigger and they get harder to solve. So we should be taking on some of that now, but that doesn't work in a political year, so in an election year. So he's pushing the problem down the road, and he's also underfunded the saving of our state colleges. They were very clear they needed $23.8 million to get to next year to reconfigure how we're running our state colleges, what majors we're going to have, how we're going to make it so that our state colleges can be solvent. And he basically said, well, if we have good fortune and something lucky happens and more money comes, then we'll pay for that. Otherwise, the current budget really gets us through about November or December when the state colleges run out of money. Well, that's not acceptable in my opinion.
One thing that you mentioned, the sort of the political aspects of budgeting, and when I had Senator Tim Ash on, the President Pro Tem of the Senate, yesterday, and he was talking about how basically every other year in Vermont we have a budgetary process and other deliberations distorted by electoral politics. And he said that's a good reason to push for a four-year term for governor. Where do you come down on that? Do you think that we should elect a governor for 4 years in Vermont?
Well, I've been presenting a hybrid process, which is that I think your first term should be 4 years, because if you want to do a larger project to, say, break down the barrier between human services and education and really delve down into the steeper levels, it's going to take more than 2 years to produce results. And, of course, Vermonters and any voters are sort of, what'd you do for me this year? What'd you do for me now? So if you have a four-year capacity to do bigger, deeper thinking about how we're providing services to Vermonters, how we can do it more efficiently, what changes can be made with the cooperation of state employees that will take time so no one will get, you know, slashed and burned, which is what often happens in a 1 or 2 year cycle. So I was thinking 4 years for your first term and 2 years per term after that. And then Vermonters have a good sense of who you are. We typically reelect everyone their first biennium anyway. They reelected Governor Scott. They reelected me 2 years ago. I can't think of the last time someone was booted out of office after their first 2 years. So let's enshrine that and then keep that old Vermont tradition and sort of the ability to kick the tires and review people every 2 years for those, you know, third, fourth, and fifth terms. Because I think that's when people have a deeper sense of someone and they go, you know, I trust them that they started a project. They'll finish it. They don't have to have the results right now or else I'll, you know, I'll kick them out. So I've got a hybrid idea I've been throwing out there. I'm curious what people think. They can always reach out and let me know. And if it's soundly rejected, well, so be it. But I thought that was a way to do a little bit of both.
I think we have a listener on the line. Is Fred from Newbury with us?
Can you hear me?
I can now. Go on. What's up, Fred?
My question is, why can't the state tighten up its budget? Every time my budget gets out of hand, I have to tighten my belt up. Why can't the state do it? And the state wants to have the rich pay for the, all the things they're paying for. And the rich, aren't the rich paying enough?
Dave Zuckerman, are the rich paying enough?
Well, a couple things. I presented an idea to the governor 3 years ago in the one meeting we've had, by the way. The governor has chosen, for better or for worse, you know, most Vermonters, we tend to disagree on things but find ways to meet and figure things out. The governor's chosen for 4 years not to meet with me, but we did meet once 3 years ago, and I said to him, why don't you and I work together on frontline education human services issues with our kids and our families and find some of those efficiencies that Fred's talking about. Tighten the belt a little bit. Look at where human services is spending money on families and kids that are struggling, and the education system through our property taxes is spending money helping these kids. What if we were to blend those two in those early years of a kid's life and look for where we're being redundant, save some money? So I agree with Fred that we got to look to find ways to be more efficient. But in a two-year cycle, there's no time to really dig down and figure those things out, which is one of the reasons we just talked about the four-year term. The other thing is you have contracts, and just as in private life, if you make a contract with somebody, you are obligated to fulfill it. And we have both written contracts with employees as well as with contractors in state government, and then we have the social contract with the people of Vermont. And that's the push and pull of the deliberative process through the legislature. Do we cut a certain program that most Vermonters maybe support that takes care of your drinking water or that takes care of, you know, kids that are from struggling families? There's a lot of different issues out there, and the majority of Vermonters who then vote in the majority of legislators have said, we want these programs to continue. Now, when it comes to whether the wealthy are paying enough or not, you know, across the country, when those folks out there sort of are believing in Trump's great America back in the 50s, did people realize that the marginal tax rate on the wealthiest was up at 80%, which means on that top income wealthy people made, they paid 80% into, quote, the system in order to fund the roads, the telecommunications infrastructure, all these things that we now take for granted, and we obviously still have to maintain. But as we keep cutting taxes on the wealthy, the burden goes on to working people. Your car registration fee goes up. Your car purchase and use tax goes up. Your permitting fee to build your house goes up. When we go to a fee-for-service governance, that is a way of shifting the expense from society as a whole, and it typically can be done on folks who are benefiting from the society as a whole, like the wealthiest, who benefit from good infrastructure, to the individuals who now are struggling. And Vermonters are struggling. I agree with Fred. You know, these fees have been going up for years under both types of administrations because no one's willing to talk about the wealthy paying their fair share. And when you look at the data, wealthy people can move wherever they want. And plenty are moving here. Just as many are moving in as are moving out. The reason people leave is more the middle class folks getting squeezed by this pressure.
All right. I think we are coming up on the half-hour mark, which means just a minute to go. Let's see if we can squeeze in one call. Tom from Richmond, I believe.
Yes, hi. This is Tom, and I thank you for the conversation. I just have one question for Mr. Zuckerman as far as the demonstrations in the city of Burlington when they prevent response and police to go to activities as far as what if somebody died because they wouldn't let the ambulance through? I'll hang up and I'll let you hear my. I'll hear your response. Thank you.
Okay. 30 seconds, Dave.
Absolutely. I think if there is a law enforcement vehicle or an ambulance coming through, just like when I drive down the road and I see one coming, I am aghast at how many people do not pull over and get out of the way. That used to be, that's how I was raised. That's how people used to be raised was
you pull over.
Emergency and those vehicles are coming through. Someone's life is in danger. No matter what I'm doing, it's not as important as getting that emergency vehicle.
We're out of time, Dave. Thank you very much, David Zuckerman, Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. For governor, rather, governor. He's currently lieutenant governor. We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well-stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program this morning. And want to introduce our next guest. Rory Waterman teaches chemistry at the University of Vermont. And he is involved in an effort involving, I think it's 21 colleges and universities around the country to enhance diversity in the sciences. They have been awarded a grant to help with this work, and seemed like an interesting piece of project, and wanted to check in with Professor Waterman about it. I believe he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, sir. Thanks for joining us.
I am. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And tell us a little bit about this project. Research Corporation for Science Advancement has awarded a team of faculty from 22, I guess it's UVM and 21 others, high-profile colleges and universities a grant with a large goal to help academic departments in the sciences overcome challenges that have consistently derailed them in the past in areas of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Tell us about this. What is this Research Corporation for Science Advancement, first off?
Sure, yeah. Research Corporation is one of the oldest foundations that supports science in the country. Their original endowment comes from Frederick Cottrell, who invented actually a way to purify emissions from coal-fired plants. And so with his gift, they've been operating for more than a century and providing support to research in chemistry, biochemistry, physics, and astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to support younger faculty through what's called the Cottrell Scholar Program. And that group of us, those awardees actually remain connected throughout our careers. And Research Corporation then provides these opportunities later to do initiatives. And so this is an initiative that we came up with at our annual meeting, which was virtual this year. Typically we meet at the foundation's headquartered in Tucson. And, you know, a variety of ideas come up, and this particular group of individuals thought that this was a good time to make some progress in this area.
The I know that there's at least a stereotype, and I suspect there's some truth to it, that the sciences are, have the hard sciences in particular, chemistry and physics and subjects like that, have been not real welcoming or just not very much populated by women, by representatives of minority groups. Do you think that, A, that's true, and B, tell us why that would be the case?
There's definitely a truth to that, and what's interesting is that there's been a good consensus in those disciplines. You know, I'm a chemist. My professional society, the American Chemical Society, is committed to improving diversity, and there's a lot of initiatives through the ACS in that area, but it's definitely been uphill, and I think the gains that we've seen, or the gains that we would hope to see, just haven't happened. One of our problems, I think, is that it is reflective of society, that there's a lot of structures that got built, you know, under systemic racism, and they seem normal to the majority, and yet they're not welcoming. And so what we really need to do is be critical and think about those structures and how everybody can be welcome in these fields at all levels.
Do you think that does any of this problem stem from or start in earlier levels of education in our elementary schools and high schools?
Oh, totally. I mean, let's be careful to not cast blame, because I think there at all levels there's barriers. You know, and I'll take full responsibility that there's excellent data that, you know, a student walking into a college or university, a student of color walking into a college or university just doesn't feel as welcome as a white student, a majority student, in that environment. And, but earlier on, absolutely, you know, we're all, you know, we're human beings. Our wiring is to have bias because it helps us survive. That's part of fight or flight, right? But those things, when, you know, not attended to in social situations, let us, you know, exclude people. And so the classic one, you know, there are still teachers who tell little girls that they're, you know, girls are not good at math. And while that's, of course, completely wrong, it's still something that comes up. And those are the sorts of things that keep people down from an early age.
Let's go even, I guess, even earlier and ask, what about families? I think, you know, it seems like you look around different fields that people imagine going into, you look at something like sports, and there just seems to be an unusual number of say siblings or father and son, father and daughter, mother and daughter, kind of combinations represented in sports. You think about this in music, and I mean, the best I can come up with is sort of anecdotes, but you think about like the Marsalis family, where every, seems like every member of this rather large family is a very serious musician. And I would imagine that you probably have a lot of chemists out there who are sons and daughters of chemists. Is that right?
There is some of that. Actually, there's I can think of a specific example of a Nobel laureate whose son is a prominent chemist as well. I think, you know, one of the things is that there's that access piece. So one of them is, of course, like sports is a great example, and music, I think, is similar, where, you know, if there's somebody in your family who already does it, you're likely to have that shared with you. I don't think a lot of people who have, for example, never gone hunting are likely to go, you know, buy a rifle and get a deer license and try to go out alone. But if their parents did, then they're very likely to have picked up that themselves. Like my dad never fished, but my grandfather on my mother's side did. So, you know, he taught me to fish, and so I like that. But it wouldn't come from my father. I science is a little like that, too, I think, in that there's this access to it as a career. There's an understanding that it is a good career. You know, a lot of families see things like, you know, being a physician or being a lawyer as an aspirational career, not being a scientist, even though it is, you know, it's a nice, I think it's a great job, but part of that is certainly comes from families, comes from environment, seeing people in your community who are involved in those things as well.
Sure. And so when folks in the sciences look around and they see that, a lot of people in our labs or in our classrooms kind of look the same, what intentional steps can you take to kind of break through these barriers?
At our level, thinking about colleges and universities, there's a couple of, known steps that we can do. One of the things is the way in which we teach our introductory classes. It's very well understood now that classic didactic lecture, that sage on a stage model, it does not advantage everybody in the classroom. And so more active pedagogies, more active classroom environments are ones in which we bring everyone up, so everyone performs better in those environments. And those contribute to retaining people in the sciences, both women and people of color. So that's right at the beginning. So now we're not losing people when they walk in the door. A lot of science is mentored through research experiences, so making sure that all of our populations know and pursue these. You know, there's a very classic advantage in higher education where students who are coming from families that have gone to college understand how college works. So there's a lot of little nuanced things. It's a new language. There's a new set of customs and cultures that make it hard to get into. One of those is that, you know, students need to actively ask for, you know, research and seek research experiences, and those are what give people advantages in their careers in the sciences. So that's another one. And then within those groups, faculty members run individual research groups, so they mentor students, and making sure that space is inclusive, that space is a place where anybody can come in and learn how to do science.
How is UVM doing individually as an institution, you know, maybe compared to other colleges and universities around the country in terms of recruiting? And by the way, I should back up before I even get to that question and ask you, let's get a good working definition of diversity, because one group that I read a lot about being feeling excluded and actually being excluded is women, and then of course people of color have also, you know, a lot of sense of exclusion from certain fields. Diversity, are we talking about you know, all these categories, or mainly focusing on racial and ethnic minorities, or how does it break down?
So for our purpose, the conversation starting with this grant, and within the context of that grant, we're focused on thinking about improving race and ethnic access. The practices that will help improve that for those folks will also help women. They should also help people of various gender identities. They're generally, if we're thinking about the best practice to be welcoming, it should be welcoming for everyone, not for, you know, one new group. And a lot of what we're talking about, you know, you asked what could we do that's different. The things that I mentioned are known, but often it's the implementation that people are struggling with. So we have a lot of well-intentioned faculty out there that just that need that push for that next step. And the group's goal is really to help them make that next step, the place where they'll really make a difference.
By the way, I have to go on a little tangent here, Rory Waterman, to just ask you, are you in any relation to the main administration building at UVM?
You know, people used to ask that when I started, and I said at the time that I would have already had tenure.
Yeah.
I think Waterman's a common enough name that I have no idea. Maybe.
Okay. I didn't know if you had a great-grandfather for whom that building was named or something, but I guess it...
No, not that I know of, yeah.
Okay. All right. Anyway, and your work in diversity, I mean, I'm sort of wondering... how was it that you are particularly singled out as the principal player at UVM on this grant? Or were you the applicant or one of the applicants? Or how did all that work?
Yeah, so I mentioned before that this is, you know, a community of folks who won one of these Cottrell Scholar Awards. There are several hundred of us now across the country over the 30 or so years that the award's been going on. And so, you know, at our annual meeting, a group of us, there's some time to brainstorm about some of this grant opportunity just to promote something in converging in research and education. You know, we started to talk about this as an idea. There's one of my collaborators at Duke, Amanda Hargrove, and a collaborator at the University of California at Davis, Jesus Velasquez. The three of us started to get the group together and organize around getting this proposal done and submitted it. So I did take the lead on that final submission, but it's absolutely a team effort.
Hmm. I was going to ask you about UVM's sort of own performance in this area. And how is UVM doing in terms of trying to recruit say students of color into chemistry and hard sciences?
You know, there's a lot of longstanding efforts at UVM to both recruit and support students. There are a lot of pieces that go into that. You know, there are identity centers that work hard every day to make sure students are in good shape on campus. The Mosaic Center for Students of Color does a fabulous job helping students. You know, there are the residential life folks work hard on this as well. Admissions is very cognizant of a lot of the systemic bias in terms of college applications and admissions, and they try to work past that. They think about what makes students successful more than, you know, coming from an affluent school. So more difficult to measure things than standardized test scores, things like grit. And a lot of those pieces are helping us to bring in, you know, a disproportionate number of students of color compared to the population of Vermont. So the campus is in that way not a microcosm of the state. So we have our entering classes are about 10 or 11% students of color at UVM, which is great because hopefully that's signaling that this is a good welcoming place to you know, get your education. Excuse me. And then when we're there, it's really the faculty are working hard to help these students succeed.
Yeah, and what do you hear from the students? Do they tend to be telling you that you know, it does feel like a welcoming and comfortable environment, or do you sense that there is some strain there, or how does it sort of play out that you can see from where, you know, your perspective?
Well, I think the important thing is it's really. It's about what the individual experiences, what any one individual experiences. There's a whole spectrum of things that actually can go wrong for a student who's, you know, coming to any campus, UVM as well. Be it microaggressions, be it outward things, openly racist things, you know, I think on one end, you know, one of our graduate students, a PhD recipient from the university, I remember said, you know, just conversationally said, you know, Vermont's the only place I've lived where I was never called the N-word. And, you know, like it's such a mixed thing. You just feel so horrible to think that that's somebody's life experience. And then, you know, it's not much a lift to imagine that that's a superlative. But, you know, our everybody, this is what we understand better now, you know, in light of the publication of, the publicity around police violence and initially what was kicked off with George Floyd killing, that we, you know, these experiences are things that I think we just have not had a good sense of as a community. And so we just need to be listening better for what people experience, and our students in particular, what they're experiencing on campus. So we can talk in sort of broad strokes, but we also need to be careful to make sure that everybody's not, that everybody's included.
Sure, absolutely. And I mean, I gather that is something that many, many people are making, are trying to make adjustments in their own lives and their own attitudes these days. And I suspect that overall I hope that overall the experience will be a positive one on sort of a society-wide basis, including on campuses. Hey, one thing I have to ask you, too, is just, I think of, you know, chemistry as a subject where you're spending a lot of time in the lab, you know, with beakers going back and forth and all that sort of classic stuff. And so now we're doing, you know, this COVID-19 crisis. We're doing a lot of distance learning and so on and so forth. How the heck does that work with chemistry?
You know, the funny thing is that we're very safety conscious as a discipline. Our students already wear personal protective equipment. Our professionals already wear personal protective equipment. So on some level, we do that. We're ready for it. We don't typically wear, you know, cloth mask face coverings, but that's just the new thing. You know, and then it's the other precautions that have been handed down from the CDC and the state, you know, where we're making sure that people are being distanced, we're disinfecting things. And, the only challenge on our side really is that for safety, we want to make sure there are people around each other. And then obviously we need to balance that with keeping each other, keeping sufficiently distant.
Right. So it sounds like you're needing to take somewhat of a hybrid approach. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, we've been able to, you know, through at least on our campus, and I know other places this is true, we've been able to reopen our labs and get back to doing science in labs because we are able to put precautions in place, you know, because of the personal protective equipment and the cleaning regimen.
Yeah, and I'm also you know, in terms of the sort of atmosphere right now on the University of Vermont campus, does it feel like a pretty odd start to a fall semester overall?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It is as we feel, right? I mean, you know, there's a mask rule on campus, so you know, as it is everywhere else, it's a strange environment not to see people's faces where, you know, we look at each other for signals.
Yeah.
You know, we're deliberately keeping density down, meaning, you know, we have lots of people working from home. There's a high number of classes that are, you know, hybrid online. You know, we're just trying to keep people safe. And so that looks very different. It doesn't look like a typical semester at all.
Yeah, it's got to be, I don't know, kind of spooky or something. In terms of the efforts to promote diversity, I mean, it must feel like that the COVID-19 crisis actually can create some degree of difficulty in pursuing those goals, just because, you know, people are not as readily able to meet and just socialize, you know, on walking to and from class and et cetera. So is that throwing up any kind of a roadblock on this project, for instance?
One of our challenges is that we need to help people have difficult conversations. That is actually mm-hmm. one of our goals. I mentioned before that, you know, the primary mode of teaching is mentored research experiences. And within a group of student researchers and a faculty member, you know, it is important to have a conversation about bias and about access and about privilege.
Yep.
They matter. And so, you know, the group's goal is to script out some of these conversations and help people develop those tools. It is, of course, harder to do that in a room when you're wearing a mask. It's also equally hard to do it, you know, virtually, you know, via
fewer people in the platform. Yep. Hey, Rory Waterman, University of Vermont chemistry professor, I got to go, but I thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning. Interesting topic, and thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty, heading into a top of the hour break for some CBS News. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We're back, and I think we're going to be talking in the next few minutes with Paul Vialis of CBS News. Is Paul with us yet? Not quite. Okay, we'll give him a minute or so, and we'll be chatting with him. He is their law enforcement analyst, and obviously there's been a lot of discussion about law enforcement lately. I think we're going to be checking in with him on the president's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin yesterday, on the goings-on in Portland, Oregon, where in both cities now we've had fatal shootings connected with protests, counter-protests, etc., in the continuing unrest over police violence against unarmed African Americans in the United States. And so we'll be chatting with that about that. And in fact, I think we do have Paul Vialis with us now, law enforcement analyst with CBS News. And Paul, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Dave. Always a pleasure to join you.
And so let's talk about Kenosha and about Portland, et cetera. How marked by violence have these protests been, and what do you think the origins of the violence might be? Let's look at Kenosha, for instance. I mean, I saw pictures yesterday of President Trump walking by a pile of rubble that I guess used to be a building. All of that, I gather, happened in connection with the unrest there over the last week or so. How widespread is that kind of the violent end of the protests?
Well, I think before we can even dive into that, Dave, it's incumbent upon us to really give a solid, realistic look at what exactly is happening. And what we're seeing in Kenosha was they never had a protest. They went right to riots. And so that, you know, no one thinks that I'm playing semantics. You know, we have a constitutional right, and it's one that we need to embrace as far as protesting. But the key word in the Constitution speaks to peaceful protests. Riots, and what we're seeing, especially in Kenosha, we're seeing the destruction of public property, the destruction of private property, and exercising excessive levels of force at law enforcement. That's exactly what we're seeing. So they bypassed protests and they went right to riots.
And is that continuing to happen in Portland as well?
Yes, it is. There's no question about that. And, you know, I know that I've heard some news reports around you're stating that, that the violence was decreasing. And I don't know who's giving that information, but from what I know from what's actually happening on the ground, that's the furthest from the truth. That's, it's not decreasing at all.
And to what extent, I mean, I see reports from time to time indicating that that sometimes these things are really sort of provocations, and that sometimes right-wing groups are involved in going out there and essentially doing violence to try to blame it on Antifa or Black Lives Matter or whatever. Is that a factor here?
No. I can tell you exactly what's happening. The protagonists are groups that are coming forth, and believe it or not, they're being flown in and they're being bused in. They're not even from those towns, the majority of the people that are creating the problems. They're coming from outside of the towns. The groups from BLM, Antifa, NFAC, and other groups are the ones that are spearheading and leading these charges. And now what we saw, which we hadn't seen before, but we saw in Kenosha, was that right side group calling themselves a self-imposed militia. Now we see them coming in heavily armed to combat the rioters that are protesting and rioting against what they feel. Most of them don't even know what they're rioting about, what they feel that they're against. And therein lies the genesis of what we should not see, because if that continues, that doesn't end well for anyone.
Well, you mentioned the constitutional protections for peaceful protest, and I'm wondering, should there be any kind of a firearms-free zone in the part of a city where this stuff is going on? Because who needs to go? If your goal is peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances, that's the phrasing from the First Amendment, first word being peaceably, right?
Right.
If your goal, do you need an AR-15?
Does who need one?
Anybody going to this event?
An individual?
Yeah,
no,
does anybody?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is what I'm saying. You know, I've been in government service for 40 years, and I will tell you unequivocally, police will defend their using their lives, people's right to protest against them. You know, you're used to and standing there and have people yell at you and scream at you. That's fine. That's okay. You know, in fact, it's what we're in business for. But the moment it starts turning to a riot, the moment you start destroying and burning, looting and throwing deadly projectiles, that no longer is a protest. That's a riot. And why people are showing up with guns? Look, you look at Wisconsin, Dave. Right? Wisconsin is an open carry state, and meaning that you can just walk around with whatever you want. Which still, I'm amazed at that part. I wouldn't even touch that. But why that is allowed, honestly, why that's allowed, I have no words for it. I can't find the slightest bit of logic in that whatsoever.
So you're a kid, a 17-year-old kid from northern Illinois, and you hear that in nearby southern Wisconsin there's this unrest going on, and you think because the business is on fire, the local police there, you saw that on TV, and the local police there didn't prevent that business from being set on fire, so they must need help. And you, I guess, grab your AR-15, cross state lines, and get ready to go in and help the local police. I mean, I think that was the thinking allegedly behind Kyle Rittenhouse's actions. Is that right?
Well, it depends who you hear it from. I mean, I've heard that story. I've heard a number of people tell me that are close to the situation that have said, you know, this is a kid that came with others, because Kenosha is in the area referred to as Chicagoland, came with others to allegedly protect the auto dealership that he had some type of affiliation with, but also was aligned with that self-imposed militia that said, we're just not going to sit back anymore and watch, quote-unquote, these people burn down our town. And you have that mentality, Dave. You have that mentality, and then you have the other side colliding in the middle at the same time that we have a cry throughout the United States to defund police so we can have fewer police. Look, this is the perfect storm, unfortunately, but this is a perfect storm that's brewing right now.
I want to quickly talk about the role of the president. Joe Biden has accused the president of you know, or has basically making the argument that the president's job here is to kind of turn down the volume on this stuff and ask everybody to sort of stand down, take a deep breath, whatever. And that this president has not been doing that and has, in fact, has been stoking. I think the verb Biden is using is stoking. A, do you agree with that? And B, do you think that the president should change his conduct here?
Well, I agree and disagree with that at the same time. I agree that the president needs to get out from behind the desk, get out of the Oval Office, and go to towns where we have this crisis and look citizens in the face. He's the president of the United States. It's a temp job at best. He reports to the citizens. So he should get out, and he should deal with this face-to-face. By making comments and on Twitter, you know, listen, I am apolitical, Dave, so this is not a political statement, but to me that's the least presidential thing you could ever do, you know, and I don't support that. I don't support that at all. You don't flame the fire. So to that extent, no, definitely not. Is his presence needed there? Think back to the Rodney King incident, and I was a commander of the State Police Academy at the time, and I dealt with the Rodney King incident for some time. President Bush, 41, against popular opinion, went to L.A. and did a lot of good while he was there. So I agree with the trip going. I disagree with some of the rhetoric that has followed. I think the president needs to kind of put a filter on that, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. As always, Paul Vialis of CBS News, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. Let's talk again soon.
Always a pleasure, sir. Have a great day.
You too. Wanted to, before it gets too late in the season and everybody's putting their boats up for the winter, wanted to talk about what appears to be a boom in boating in Vermont this summer, and it's really quite something. Apparently, a lot of folks have been looking for hobbies, new things to take up, or restoration of old things they used to do and want to get back into, boating has been a booming thing in Vermont in the last several months. The COVID-19 crisis having a lot of weird and negative economic impacts. Here's a positive one we thought we'd focus on for the next bit of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I have two people in the boating business to talk to us about this. Steve Brownlee from Umiak Outdoor Outfitters will be talking to us, I think, about mainly the paddle sports ends of things. And, Steve, thank you very much for joining me. I know you're really busy this morning, may not be able to spend the whole time with us, but we'll try to get your words in edgewise early on here. And thank you for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
All righty. And Mike Baudette is with Gillies Sales and Service in East Montpelier. I think they're more on the power boating end of things in the when they do boats. I know they do some other power equipment as well. But Mike Baudette, thank you very much for joining us this morning as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And, Steve, I want to start with you and ask you, I was talking to you a little bit the other day, and it sounded like you were basically having trouble keeping kayaks in the shop almost. What's going on with kayak sales this year?
Yeah, our kayak sales, and this is not just, you know, Vermont in our territory, but New England, around the U.S., Canada, and around the world, kayak sales have been, and canoe and stand-up paddleboard, people wanting to get out in their self-powered boats, have skyrocketed popularity this year. And as soon as the governor sort of gave the release to go out and play, we saw a huge spur in sales. And we were all kind of concerned what the effects were going to be of COVID. Most of us boating shops, we place our orders for product. Like right now, we're placing our orders for next year. So we do it pretty far in advance, and our products are shipped during the winter time and or early spring. And we got, as soon as the governor said it was okay to come out and play, boy, did folks come out and purchase kayaks. and wow. we sold everything that we had ordered for the spring in the first month. And then it was, how can we get resupplied? And so mm-hmm. we certainly tried to get as much as more product from our manufacturers as we could. But because those manufacturers were closed for a period of time of COVID, their capacity to have boats in inventory was quite down. And their ability to resupply and restock once they reopened under COVID regulations, they couldn't produce as much as they normally do. So production of kayaks, stand-up paddle boards, and canoes were down, 50 to 200% from their normal capacity. And, of course, demand was up to the sometimes 500% up from its normal capacity. So it was an interesting spring for sure.
Yeah, and what has that done for prices? I mean, my economics 101 tells me supply and demand is going to make the price tag go up.
Yeah, I think every retailer experienced the fact that there was nobody sort of looking for special deals. It was more, do you have the kayaks? And mm-hmm. We were seeing shortages in the industry in mid-June. And so normally there's, some early season sales, and we had those in May, when we first opened up. But then, it was just, could you get the product for the customer? And what we found here in Umiak, because we are one of the largest, boating, vendors in Vermont, and we work with so many different, paddling manufacturers, we were always able to keep some product in the store from one vendor or another. We mm-hmm. never ran out of kayaks, stand-up paddle boards, or canoes throughout the season, but I know many, many retailers throughout New England that did. They were out of boats for, 30, 40 days at a time.
Wow.
So there wasn't much sales or discounts going. Some of us who had inventory, leftover boats from the year before or even longer, older boats that may have not been in great demand, we, of course, had those at discounted prices, and they did. We have clean shelves right now. Let's put it that way. There's no product from the past sitting on the shelves of any retail paddle sports stores right now.
Let me quickly ask Mike Baudette of Gilly's Sales and Service in East Montpelier how that looks from the motorboat end of things. Did you have any times this year, Mike, when you basically had nothing to sell?
Well, we're kind of in the same position where we order our boats this time of year for next year, and we had our normal orders in for what we would have for the season. In the spring we put in, orders for customers that are just ordering, the boat they want or motor they want or something like that. So we actually came into the season pretty well stocked. As the season progressed along, we were running out of different models or different styles of boats. We weren't able to replenish them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true, across the line, whether it was outboard motors or boats or trailers. The other part of our business, of course, is the service side, and where we have had a lot more issues is, getting parts for units that are down that we're servicing.
Mm-hmm.
Mercury is one of our big lines, and then we have a couple big supply houses that we get product from, and all summer it's been hit or miss. You put in a 30-item order, and they ship you 5 of those items.
Yikes.
Which made it tough.
Yeah.
And then we, as the summer has progressed along and they're starting to catch up with some of that, this stuff keeps trickling in every day. We get some stuff that, may have been ordered in May and June and is now coming in. So that's been an issue, trying to keep people happy with, you know, getting their boat serviced and getting them back in the water.
Sure.
But it's, well, you know, that's part of it.
And Steve Ronley and Umiak, I'm just wondering, when people come into the stores there and talk with you about, you know, I want to buy a kayak or I want to buy a paddleboard, canoe, whatever, do they actually mention the COVID? Like, this is something I can do to get out of the house and not have to worry about so much about, you know, social distancing and all that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was definitely the main thing on most folks' minds is that, yeah, we are doing this because of COVID and we want a social distance. Many of them were, yeah, we thought of this before. We've always wanted to do this, but we figured this is the year to do it. And what we saw very early in the season in May and in June was for us was a big spike in canoes and tandem kayaks for families, and because COVID changed people's activities for the summer, being summer camps were canceled for many kids, so they were at home with their parents. Many, you know, summer soccer leagues or softball leagues or those sorts of sporting events were all canceled, and so parents were looking for ways to get out and spend quality time with their kids and get them out of the house, because they, you know, with COVID, you were home with your kids for, you know, 3-4 months, and the electronics, games and TV and all those things were the circle for the kids. And it's like, okay, it's summer. Let's get out. Let's do something. What are we going to do this year? And, you know, getting in a canoe or a kayak and going for overnight camping or just a day of fun on the water was a natural thing.
Hmm. So it sounds like there's a little bit of a demographic shift almost to more families coming into your stores. Is that right? Or
absolutely. Yep.
Hmm. That is interesting. And Mike Burdett, have you found the same thing that this is something that you're drawing more families into boating as opposed to just individuals who want to go fishing or something?
Yeah, but we saw that early on also, you know, where they had to spend some time or a lot more time home because of no activities, as Steve mm-hmm. has mentioned. And we said families coming in would have 2 or 3 kids and figure out, we're going to get a boat. That's why we can, you know, social distance and have fun tubing or skiing or doing whatever. And that was a big part of our business this summer was the family, which I enjoyed that because it brought the families together, you know.
Sure.
A lot of families go a million different directions over the years, and this year you had to kind of stay together, so it worked out very well.
Like it or not.
Yeah.
So, Steve, I'm wondering, I'm sort of hearing 3 different, I don't know, tracks from you or whatever. You got kayaks, you got canoes, you got stand-up paddle boards. What of those three are the, I mean, rank them in terms of popularity and then tell me whether that's changing at all.
Well, each of those activities goes through their sort of waves of popularity. You know, canoes have, for 200 years, you know, they've been the mainstay of the self-paddling community, and we've always sold lots of canoes. Umiak's a business. We've been doing this for close to 30 years now, and, you know, when we opened, it was all canoeing. And we would sell 100 canoes a year. But then when kayaks came out, particularly the polyethylene plastic, fairly inexpensive kayaks compared to the heavily labored composite boats that were expensive. But when polyethylene plastic came out 20 years ago and the recreational kayak came out, we saw a big change and shift of people buying more kayaks and less canoes. Then stand-up paddleboarding came out about 10 years ago, and more people took on, you know, tried that activity out. And we are seeing that the you know, sort of the curve of the excitement for stand-up paddleboarding was starting to wane. We weren't selling the numbers that we were, just like canoes, we weren't selling the numbers. But this COVID just has changed everything, because the popularity of all of them just spiked. And for me, the biggest spike I saw, and I think it was really the families, was the canoes. We are back selling 100 canoes a year, and we haven't seen that for 30 years. So that's
wow.
That's a major shift in what consumers were doing. So, and I think it's really exciting to see families and people being reintroduced to this, because our free time with our kids and doing stuff, as a family, had really changed in the last number of years, and COVID has readjusted our priorities.
Yeah, it certainly seems to have done that in many ways. Steve Brownlee, can you stay with us a little bit after the break, or do you need to get out?
I can stay with you for a little bit longer.
Okay, well, we do need to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. A couple words from our sponsors, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Mike Baudette of Gillies Sales and Service in East Montpelier, and also with Steve Brownlee of Umiak, Stowe, Waterbury, and Richmond. We'll be back, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the final half hour of our program this morning. It's Wednesday, September the 2nd, 2020, and the topic du jour, at least, or du hour, is boating. The boating boom that folks are seeing here in Vermont and elsewhere as people kind of change up their activities in the COVID-19 crisis, more family activities, and a lot of folks out there deciding, yeah, let's get out on the water. There's good social distancing, and we could just have a lot of fun. And my guests are Steve Brownlee. He's the owner of Umiak, which has Umiak Outdoor Outfitters, has shops in Stowe, Waterbury, and Richmond. And Mike Baudette of Gillies Sales and Service over in East Montpelier. They're more on the powerboat end of things. And Mike, I'm curious from your perspective, do you sense any shift in emphasis for people coming in? Some people get out on the water on motorboats because they want to go fishing. Other people get out because they want to do water skiing and wakeboarding and those kinds of activities. What would you say is a majority for your people, and is that shifting at all?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is a lot more of the going out tubing and skiing than the fishing side of it. It's just it's something they do with the kids, and there's a lot more families that are getting into it, and of course they want everybody to be able to participate, and it seems the tubing and skiing part of it is a better setup for everybody. Fishing is a good pastime, and we have a lot of fishermen that do that. But the playing around, skiing and tubing is still more popular at this point, and that's what we've been seeing this summer.
Now, Steve Brownlee over at Umiak, you guys don't do powerboats, do you?
No, we don't. No, everything's human powered here at Umiak.
And how are the I mean, again, there's more watercraft of all types out there on the water these days. Certainly that would be one result of increasing sales for both of your businesses. And how are folks getting along out there? I know sometimes there's a little bit of a, I don't know, rivalry or yeah. general crusty relations occasionally. What's going on out there?
Well, we've definitely seen some impact. Where it came to fruition this season early on was the actual boating access points. And Waterbury Reservoir being the local spot for your listeners, I'm on the board of the Friends of Waterbury Reservoir and very involved with the greeting program and all of the invasive species work that we do on the Waterbury Reservoir, and we monitor the access points, and there's four of them on Waterbury Reservoir. The state put in three new boat ramps last season on the access points. Actually, Green Mountain Power actually paid for all that boat ramps that were put out there. And that made it easier for motorboaters to access. So we saw more motorboat access. But the other thing that happened was the Vermont State Parks didn't open up early in the season because of COVID. And so one of those access points at Waterbury Center wasn't available for motorboaters and paddlers to go into. And so we saw huge, huge numbers of cars parked at the access points during the month of starting in the tail end of May and in June. The parking lots were just jammed. So that was the first area of mixed use happening out there. Once folks get on the water, we do get sort of spread out. But I think that one of the things that folks, because there were so many new people who hadn't been paddlers going out, who bought canoes or stand-up paddle boards or kayaks for the first time and motorboats as well, is getting out. When you're out on the water, it's like, well, where should I be? Stand-up paddle boarders should not be in the middle of the lake. They should be in that 200-foot non-wake zone along the shores of Waterbury Reservoir, all lakes. That's the place to be because the power boats are needing that their space in the middle of the lake, and of course they're not in that 200-foot wake zone on the shorelines. So it's educating those new paddlers of what's the protocol and what's the appropriate way to get out and recreate with others.
Let's go to a listener call. I believe it's Fred from Montpelier on the line. Good morning, Fred.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I have both a power boat that I bought from one of your sponsors, and I also have a stand-up paddle board so I can speak out of both sides of my mouth.
Excellent.
The big problem
good.
With all these new paddlers is who's paying for these access areas? Me and my power boat, my trailer registration, my boat registration, my fishing tackle, and my fishing license. Meanwhile, the paddlers do not pay anything, and I've recommended this in the past. I think a nominal fee should be put on the paddlers, and I'm willing to pay for my paddle boat. And I'm talking nominal fee, like $10. You get to some of these fishing access areas, you can't even get your boat or trailer turned around. And if everybody paid something into it, I think the parking could be better arranged and everybody would enjoy themselves. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Fred. That's an interesting point. What do you think, Steve Brownlee? Should people with canoes and kayaks and paddleboards, you know, the paddle sports end of things, should they be paying a fee for using the boat access areas?
Well, I definitely agree that people should pay to play and help support these access points. It has been brought to Vermont legislatures in the past several times in my 30 years of business here about having registrations for small crafts. And what has always come down to is it costs the state more money to monitor and regulate a $10 fee than it would be to the revenue that it generated. That was sort of the outcome that they did the last time they studied it. But we definitely have, as our population grows and we expand, whether it's a riverfront or lakefront, access to those bodies of water has reduced tremendously in the last 30 years that I've been out there. And many times the state, one of the ways that they sort of limit how many people can be out on the waters is they limit the parking space. And when the parking is full, it's like, okay, we've reached capacity. But as we grow as a state and a nation, we have to continue to protect access areas and keep them in good shape for all the users. So that is definitely a topic. How we best pay for it. Your caller is correct. We need to. There is a way for paddlers to, participate and pay to play. I think that's something that should be revisited again.
Yeah, interesting. Mike Bundad, what's your sense of this situation? Should paddlers be chipping in to help maintain the maintain the boat launches?
I would think that it would be a good idea this way. As Steve says, they need more revenue to, improve these parking areas or just upkeep these parking areas. For a very minimal fee, whether it's $10 or $20, anybody can afford to do that, to help out.
Yeah, some years I've bought, I haven't actually been out on the, for my own reasons, I haven't been out on the water as much this year, so I haven't done this yet this year, but I may still. I have a little sailboat on a trailer, so I of course pay to register the trailer. Some years I've bought a fishing license, even if I don't think I'm going to be doing that much fishing, or I might go fishing once or twice or something. But and one of the reasons I think about buying the fishing license is just to say, so I'll that's my method of chipping in a little bit for the ramp upkeep, because in the years that I have. Taking my sailboat out more frequently, I tend to feel like I ought to do something to help out with the overall picture there. I don't know whether anybody's given any thought to sort of promoting a voluntary program like that, which would probably help to take care of the problem of a fee system being more expensive to administer than lucrative for the state. Would something like that make sense? Sort of a voluntary system like that make sense to you, Steve Brownlee?
Yes, I think it does. I recommended that to the state a number of times of making it. Many parks out west have these metal boxes that you put your self-pay, you go to a campsite or something, you put your money in this little metal vault box that's at the access point. Then once a week the park comes along and collects that money and puts it to good use. And I think that, many Vermonters, kayakers, canoers, paddlers, and motorboaters, they would go to a great access point, have a wonderful time, see that little box there to contribute, and would say, hey, we'd like to give to this fund. We could do the same thing on our tax returns. We have, give to the loons and the wildlife. We could have a spot that says, hey, I'd like to contribute, X amount of dollars towards boat access for Vermont.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach as well. Hey, let's see. The call-in number is 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. My guests are Steve Brownlee of Umiak Outdoor Outfitters, Mike Baudette of Gillies Sales and Service in East Montpelier, and we're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show, and when we return, perhaps we can get a couple calls in from listeners.
Come, create, connect, and celebrate at the Grange Hall Cultural Center, Waterbury's community center for the arts, recreation, and celebration of the gifts, talents, and people of this area. This historical structure was built to gather people of all ages together around activity that builds strong community and happy hearts. Since the 1850s, its history is rich with a flow of ideas, industrial work ethics, creative endeavor, the sharing of experience, acts of community service, and lots of celebration. At the Grange Hall Cultural Center, you will find this tradition continued with arts opportunities of all kinds that include, inspire, and entertain the variety of people and interests in our wonderful community. Come hold your own events, meetings, classes, presentations, art, and celebrations under the Grange Hall's roof. Now in the process of upgrades to preserve this community gathering space, the Grange Hall Cultural Center will remain Waterbury's self-sustaining, multi-generational community center for generations to come. Grange Hall Cultural Center, 317 Howard Ave, Waterbury Center, Vermont. GrangeHallCC@gmail.com.
The NASCAR Cup Series.
Jimmy Johnson up the racetrack. Kevin Harvick down to the bottom of the racetrack. Jimmy Johnson clears him into...
Is at Darlington Raceway.
Ferrari sideways. Jimmy Johnson spins.
The Cup Series playoffs kick off at the track too tough to tame.
Here comes Chase Elliott. He gets turned hard into the inside wall.
It's the Cookout Southern 500. Sunday afternoon at 5 on the Motor Racing Network.
Central Vermont's home for the NASCAR Championship is WDEV.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back. We're talking about the boating boom in Vermont and elsewhere, of course, mainly in Vermont, because that's where we are. But my guests are Mike Baudette. He is the owner of Gillies Sales and Service in East Montpelier. They do a lot of motorboat sales and service. And then Steve Brownlee is with Umiak Outdoor Outfitters. They're based in Stowe, Waterbury, Richmond, and they focus a lot on paddle sports. And I'm going to ask each of you in turn. I guess I'll start with Steve. How late into the year does your season normally extend? I get it, you know, sales probably die off when November winds blow or something. But what is your general season?
Here at Umiak, we generally slow down about now. Although there's a surge of individuals who like to get out in September and October. After the families and kids have sort of left, the seniors like to get out there and enjoy the lakes in the latter part of the season. So we always see a fair number of older folks getting out during the foliage period and now. But generally, boat sales do slow down, but we haven't seen that. We had a shipment of 30 kayaks, high-end lightweight kayaks, come into the store a couple of days ago, and every single one of them were gone in a day. People haven't slowed down from buying. And there's still demand. I am placing lots of orders for boats for next season for folks, because we can't get exactly what they want now. But they're willing to wait for it, and they don't want to lose out, as many of them did lose out this year because what they wanted wasn't available.
Yeah, interesting. Mike Burnett, same question to you. How late does your season normally last? And it seems like, I mean, this is just a guess, but I would imagine that maybe it shifts a little more toward fishing and, I don't know, maybe bird watching interest later in the season when the water gets a little nippy for tubing and stuff.
Yeah, typically with us, with our sales, usually. August starts to slow down a little bit. We didn't see that this year. It's been very busy all through August. Even this week we're doing sales that we wouldn't normally do in a normal year. But what we're experiencing is that people that were missed out on getting their boats this summer because they couldn't find the one they wanted is driving a lot of people that are pre-ordering boats for next season. as far as people using the boats, typically we go through the middle of October, even with the pleasure boaters, because they want to see the foliage or they, you know, just spending time on the water. The fishermen, the fishermen will stay out there a little longer. They will go right into November, you know, weather permitting, and fish for a while longer.
Wow.
I wanted to interject.
Yeah, sure.
Too is one of the things that we've seen happening is that we have a big rental operation. We rent kayaks and canoes down at the Waterbury Reservoir day use area, and we've extended our time out there renting through September. Normally we would close this weekend, Labor Day weekend, but we've extended that because so many people are really wanting to get out there. Schools have been sort of delayed a little bit, and so we are seeing lots of demand for people to continue to do this these activities during this period. And we normally have a gigantic end of the season used boat sale this weekend, which we will have, but we won't have as many boats. We normally have about 200 used boats for sale, but because we're keeping our outposts open, our river trips are continuing, our lake programs are continuing, then we only have about half those boats available for sale this weekend. But it's you know, people have not slowed down at all wanting to get out on the water.
That's amazing. And, of course, you guys are, it sounds like both of you are sort of making hay while the sun shines, as the farmers say. Hey, let's bring in another listener, I think, is on the line. Is it Tom from Moortown?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm coming from a different direction, I guess, a little bit on this registration of kayaks, paddle boat stuff. And even the pedal bike stuff, as far as getting them registered for some sort of identification. I've been on the water. I am a fishing guide. I fish on Lake Champlain, and I have had kayaks come across, you know, close enough to go through lines and different things, and they don't care. I drove school bus. I had pedal bikers go through the red lights, right through the kids getting off. And when you holler to them, who are you? You get, you know, whatever. You get sworn at. And you have no way of identifying these people, so they can pretty much do what they want and get away with it. They're in helmets. Can't, you know, you don't know who they are. So I think the registration thing would be just like our vehicles would be a identification thing for those purposes. Of course, the money would help. And if it's going to cost the state too much to do this, I would think they would figure it out and do like education or anything else is here's what it's going to cost us. Here's what we got to charge. And that's how you set the fee. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tom. Let's see. I'll ask Steve to maybe take a swing at that one. What do you think of that of those remarks there, Steve?
I had a hard time hearing all of them, but what my understanding was is that he's looking to be able to report people who are misbehaving and maybe not be educated on how to work with others out on the water or at the boat access. I'm not sure that that way of policing is the best way. I really think that, you know, education is what we really need, and, of course, more so now than ever before with all the new paddlers getting out there. One of the ways to do that is through the organizations that are trying to work to preserve and protect these resources that we have. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm on the board of the Friends of Waterbury Reservoir. There's a Friends of Green River Reservoir. There's a Friends of the Winooski River, the Lamoille River. These are all organizations that are out there trying to preserve and protect and educate. And that's what we, you know, we have websites and pamphlets and brochures that we try to hand out to people. We have greeters at each of the access points to work with the boaters as they come into the access points and give them that education. I really believe that people aren't being malicious. They don't know any better, and we need to educate them. And your show helps.
Well,
you know, having this discussion helps.
Yeah, I'm glad we can do what we help out with that. Mike Baudet, I'm wondering, do you agree? Do you think that basically I know motorboats have a number on the side. Somebody can report a misbehaving motorboat driver, I gather. Should that be the case with kayaks, or is education the way to go?
Well, I think you're going to need education, but also something else that they could try. I mean, we're in the snowmobile business, and with snowmobiling, they have snowmobile clubs, and you have to be a member of the club to use the trails. So, you know, if the state didn't want to get involved as heavily, you could have, you know, kayak clubs or paddleboard clubs or whatever, and they issue a registration number as such, you know, to put on your board or in this case on snowmobiles. And then they pay their dues, every year, to use the trails.
And then fascinating
idea. A portion of that goes back to the state.
Sure. Well, hey, listen, I got to get, because I'm coming up to the top of the hour and the end of the program today, but I really appreciate the two of you for spending this time with us this morning. Steve Brownlee of Umiak Outdoor Outfitters and Mike Baudet of Gillies Sales and Service. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for participating.
Glad we actually be a part of it.
All righty. Hey, as I mentioned, we are fast approaching the end of today's program on the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, on this Wednesday morning. I'm taking a couple days off again. I'm taking my vacation this summer in small bites, and Thursday and Friday this week are part of it. So I'll join you all again on Monday, and stay healthy out there, everybody. We'll talk to you on Monday.